You may smoke, Mr. Bond. In case you have any other intentions, you may care to lean forward and inspect the keyhole of the drawer in this desk facing your chair. I shall be ready for you in a moment. Bond leant forward. It was a large keyhole. In fact, Bond estimated 0.45 centimeters in diameter. Fired, Bond supposed, by a foot switch under the desk. What a bunch of tricks this man was.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the James Bond Complex. I'm one of your two co-hosts, Edgar.
I'm Matt.
Here we are on another lovely Sunday afternoon. We are going to tackle Ian Fleming's second novel, published in 1954, Live and Let Die. Don't we have some fascinating things to talk about with this one? Shall we maybe share what the plot is a little bit before we go ahead?
A few months after the events of Casino Royale, James Bond is back in action. Bonaparte Ignace Gallia, a.k.a. Mr. Big, a smirch agent who has been laundering coins of 17th century pirate treasure through Harlem, New York. For this assignment, 007 is teamed up with his American counterpart, Felix Leiter. Their investigation takes the two agents through the underground world of Harlem clubs, where Bond encounters the big man himself, but also is bribed to be solitaire. Bond and Leiter follow the villain's pipeline through Florida with Mr. Big's woman in tow. The adventure takes on a tragic turn when Felix Leiter is brutally maimed and left for dead while Solitaire is retaken by Mr. Big's goon. James Bond finally heads to L'Île of Surprise, the location of the treasure that Mr. Big has been taking and laundering through Harlem. Bond finally destroys the operation, barely survives his encounter as he and Solitaire finally consume their relationship.
Look, reading Live and Let Die, I think there are a couple of ways we can broach this. We can probably start, I mean, we will talk about what we thought of the book and the plot, you know, how the characters and such, but there are also other very specific cultural...
Let's address, head first, let's discuss
racism. We're courageous.
Yes.
We're bold. Right. Let's talk about racism. The book starts off innocently enough because it's basically just James Bond and he's at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. Oh, well, no, he gets out of the airport, actually. He's off on his way to the St. Regis Hotel to work with the CIA and Felix Leiter. So those first couple chapters are okay. It's once Felix and Bond have a night on the town in Harlem that things get really interesting. And just the way Bond... And M, actually, because there's kind of like in Casino Royale, there's a flashback chapter. Mm-hmm. It's exactly like Casino Royale, actually.
They follow a lot of the same structure. I think most of the books follow that structure of him being on a mission and then having a flashback when he gets the mission.
You're absolutely right. I actually got ahead of myself when I said it's once Bond and Felix Leiter have a night on the town in Harlem that things get a little weird. It is actually in the flashback chapter where M says things like, well, you know, black people are half or a third percentage of the white population on this world. It's normal that they would have surgeons and doctors and this and that. And naturally, they'll have criminal gangsters. And Bond is like, I've never heard of a black criminal gangster before. You read these lines and you go like, okay, it's written by a white dude in the early 1950s. Just take it, swallow it, and get to the next chapter. But then the next chapter is not necessarily all that all that better.
But it's racist in a way that your grandfather or great-grandfather in some cases is racist. It's not mean, it's just, it just disregards everyone that's not exactly like you are.
Hindsight is 20/20, as the expression goes, but it's like innocent, right? Like, we didn't know better back then, so we just said dumb things. It doesn't excuse it, but if you can put it into that context, and I did, it wasn't my first time reading Live and Let Die, maybe the second or third time, but every time I've read it, it's a little weird, but if you can somehow box it into that context, well, this is just how... non-black people thought, or Caucasian specifically, because most of the characters in these books are Caucasian anyways, but you know, that's just how people thought back then. It doesn't completely forgive the philosophy, but if you can understand it, it makes it a little bit more digestible. So I still managed to, you know, make my way through those passages, even though it was a little weird.
It's weird. It is weird. You have, when you approach this book, you have to be aware of this issue.
But one of the other things I noticed about the quote racism thing was how not just in the Caribbean islands where we go to later in the book. Even when we're still in New York and in Harlem, Bond is impressed by how voodoo has a hold on these people. Mm-hmm. And this is amazing. We're in a civilized society. We're in New York City, the 20th century, and these people are afraid of voodooism. But the book does deliberately, to a degree, sort of hamper home that point. Well, these black people, I mean, it's you just bring out a voodoo doll and you have them in the palm of your hands. There is a little bit of that in the book.
Yeah, that part was disturbing. Like I said, it was written at a time where people didn't know better. It was right at the beginning of the Cultural Revolution.
Political emancipation,
yeah,
I suppose.
Yeah, the emancipation. Everything around that time was about to happen. And I think that was just Caucasian white paranoia that seeps its way in through to that book.
Which is funny because... And you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this on and off during the book podcast, but Ian Fleming, if you've read interviews with Ian Fleming, in fact, there's a very good one in the James Bond archives published by Taschen, and essentially he's not, like, he's a fairly sophisticated guy. He's not, like, overtly racist, but he had those issues, if to a lesser... softer degree, but I guess even he thought a little bit like that back then. I mean, otherwise he wouldn't have described Harlem the way he does in the book. So.
Well, I think the way he describes Harlem in that book is he doesn't understand it, but he's fascinated by it. That's the thing I noticed. Because there's a chapter where he reads from a book about British...
Bond's in the hotel room, and he picked up a book. I think M suggested he read this book about Buddha, because that might come into play. You don't know this Mr. Big Guy. He's a Baron Samedi.
I'm certain that Fleming probably went to New York. He obviously went to the St. Regis Hotel, did some research himself, went to the same goddamn clubs, and probably had similar experience, but he was probably shocked and fascinated by it. But you have to think, he's a stuck-up British guy who's probably, his values probably come from more from the 19th century than the 20th century. So he's a little out of his depth when he goes to Harlem and he's, wow, that culture was on its way, it was about to blow up big time. Like, the black communities were getting more and more...
they asserted themselves.
They asserted themselves. That's what I'm trying to say, and I thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
They're on the verge of finally asserting themselves, and he's just, what is... for him, it's a safari.
In fairness, he spends, half the year in London and then half the year in Jamaica on his private estate, where he probably has black people serving him lunch. So it's like, you took the words right out of my mouth. He is... impressed, amazed, but at the same time out of his depth. That's probably the key sentence to describe that.
The way when he goes to the club and he him and Felix Leiter, now I'm not talking about Fleming.
No, we're talking about Bond. Felix Leiter is a fictional character. He never really existed.
When they see that stripper, he's the way he describes it, it's like his mouth gets dry and he's never seen anything like that.
It's brilliant. The way he describes that club when the lights go out, and the light shines on this stripper who I believe is extremely scantily clad, before actually going in the nude fully, it's really... I mean, again, I'm sure we talked about this a little bit in the Casino Royale podcast, but I mean, holy smokes, this guy's descriptions. Awkward though they may be because of the whole, bizarre...
the language he uses at times.
Yeah, because the language is maybe a little bit off-putting just because of that sort of cultural relativism, but it's still really impressive. Despite how awkward it is, you do feel like you're there in that club appreciating this wild show. It's cool.
I don't know if you did the same thing I did. I know when I'm reading those books, I listen to it in audio form, then I reread the passages that caught my attention. If there's a little detail, like the St. Regis, I verify that it's still open and you can still go to the bar. And I'm certain the next time I go to New York, I'm going to go to that bar and have a drink at the same place, because I'm certain Fleming went there and probably got some ideas while being at that bar. But I also look at most of the locations are in Harlem. That version of Harlem was gone in 4 or 5 years after the book was published. All those clubs that he mentions, gone. the Sugar Ray, the Boxers Club, before the decade was over. Not only was that thing closed, but he was, like, at one point, Leiter and Bond say, oh, he was smart, he quit while he was ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
He went back to boxing, like, 2 years later. And he boxed for almost another decade. The guy, yes, but it's tiny window in a period of Harlem that doesn't exist.
His description of Harlem is like the perfect time capsule, because it wasn't like that just a few years later. But thank goodness we fixed all our racism problems.
Yeah. And, yes, exactly.
Exactly. No controversy here, folks.
No. Well, I don't want to spend my time. Like, there's a lot of things I liked. I liked the villain. Like, I want to talk about Mr. Yeah, Big.
Let's get down to the story. Let's get down to the adventure now.
But Mr. Big, the way he's described, he's a human shark.
Isn't he described like a human football?
No.
That is
Think
a
about it. The way he describes both eyes.
The very you wide. Can't fo- Not wide, but the very far apart. And...
His skin turned gray because of his heart condition. Mm. He's completely bald.
Interesting.
It's a shark. I'm telling you, he's meant to be a human shark.
That's pretty clever. I did not pick up on that. The descriptions are so colorful and delightful that you don't really need to interpret a whole lot when you read Fleming. But nevertheless, you still, you know, formulate a certain picture in your mind. To me, I did not think of the shark, despite the gray skin. But he seems a little bit, he's a little bit burly. Like, you wouldn't tackle this guy, you know, on the football field.
No.
Like, he's a big
like six
guy. He's apparently he has decent muscle. He consumes a lot of women, which I think Le Chiffre did as well.
Yeah.
These villains, man. These villains. Oh, debauchery. But I agree. He's a lot of fun. And I like the fact that whereas in our previous book, we were dealing with a villain who was of moderate intelligence, certainly a little bit sneaky, but certainly defeatable. Here we're dealing with... This is a completely different ballgame. This guy is the evil Batman. He... When you think you figured out his plan B, he has already completed plan D, like, just so you know. You know, and that makes it really, really interesting, which in a funny way also plays into the fact that Fleming and his characters are so surprised by, you know, they're so surprised by a black criminal. So I think he's almost heightens that to such an extent that this guy is a freaking genius. He's an evil genius, but he is almost unstoppable because he has so many people under his power. And the way he speaks, it's very... Very calm.
Yeah.
He doesn't get excited.
No, he's very neutral, very well-spoken.
Very well-spoken, speaks slowly, looks. And he'll look you in the eye and speak. Sometimes he'll look at you in the eye, but not say a word. Is he trying to intimidate you? Is he just thinking about something else and you happen to be in his line of vision? That happens a couple of times in the book. And it's as interesting as Le Chiffre was in Casino Royale. I like Mr. Big a heck of a lot more.
Mr. Big is a better villain. He's not incompetent. When you think about it, Le Chiffre was a bit of he was incompetent. That's why.
Yeah. He got a little unlucky, but yeah. he's kind of incompetent. Whereas Mr. Big is on top of everything.
Yeah, no, he's not trying to cover up his mistakes. He's just, no, I'm doing my job. I'm a criminal and I'm professional about it. And you're in my way, so I'm going to break your finger.
And I think the way Fleming used, and the number of time he has Mr. Big appear in the story is very interesting as well. He's not like in every chapter. He's mentioned a lot.
Yeah.
But he's only physically in about four, like one near the start, the finger scene, and about three or four at the end. And that's it. We don't
Well, he's at the beginning and the end. He's mentioned. Bond meets him twice.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that's it.
But... Because, you know, we won't spend, you know, an hour and a half getting into all the plot details, but there are obviously, you know, tons of little exciting adventures and challenges for Bond and Solitaire to overcome. And each and every single one of them that Bond confronts, there's always that little line, oh, damn, Mr. Big knew I was coming. Or, oh, damn, Mr. Big had this prepared.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so he keeps being referenced again and again and again that the few times where he does appear... Yes, the Fleming physical description is impeccable, but we've had so much proof of his genius that he's even scarier when he's physically there.
They built up his power, his presence by talking about it. Also, he has so many agents and henchmen and hench people that, in a way, he might not be physically always present, but his tentacles are always he's always around somewhere somehow.
Absolutely, absolutely.
From Harlem to Florida, all the way to Jamaica.
Jamaica, yes, Jamaica. And I don't remember all of the names, but a lot of his henchmen have pretty cool. I mean, some of them will show up in the film. There's a Teehee, there's a Whisper. But there are tons of names, like Flash and One. I don't know, I'm inventing stuff, but it's these like one or two word names that none of these characters have real names. They don't have like Christian names. They just have like these street code names because they're kind of like spy. They are the 007s. They have their code names, you know.
They have gangster names, the gangster nicknames.
Absolutely. We do have a Bond girl,
mm-hmm.
Solitaire. Now, if memory serves, last time Vesper Lynn was an amorphous blob.
Yes, I think that was the term. That's the term I used. I much prefer Solitaire, but she's not yet a very solid character. She's a little more interesting, a little bit more fleshed out. She doesn't do much in the mission. She's a damsel in distress, but she's a bit more interesting. I get more personality. I can get a voice where Vesper Lynn, all she was a bunch of lines and a dress tied up over her head. That's...
Mm. Well, Vesper Lynn was always very distant, whereas Solitaire is actually the opposite. When she sees Bond, I mean, poor bastard is tied in a chair. He's about to have his little pinky finger broken, but he's facing a Solitaire. For the life of me, I can't remember what Mr. Big is asking her to do. And she gives him this look, very brief, but this look in the eye of desire, like, can you help me get the hell out of here?
No.
So right off the bat, there's this intention on her part to get close to Bond, to flee Mr. Big's clutches. So there's already this this willingness on her part to be a more proactive character, yes, than Vesper, who was really intentionally distant throughout the whole book. I agree. Solitaire's a little bit more interesting. I also agree that she's not the most fleshed out character Fleming's ever written. There's a little bit of
She's an upgrade.
She's an upgrade. She's like half an upgrade because she's still a bit of a damsel in distress.
No, she is, but because of her situation, I'm like, oh, she's in a bad place. She's about to get forcibly married to Mr. Big, and she doesn't want to have any of it. She wants out. She's been trapped.
We get a bit of backstory too, which helps. She's like, she had a French family, and what the hell was it? French family, the old land, I think, and they lost it.
Yes.
And he found her. I can't remember where. Where did he find her?
Cabaret. She was doing an act because she does have, just as in the movie, she has some type of psychic powers. She can, yes, sort of infer what people are thinking. Mr. Big, when he saw her, couldn't figure out her trick, so he convinced her. I don't think he abducted her. I think he offered her a part in the show, and he coerced her into coming to America, and since then he's completely taken her over her life.
There's an example, although that is an interesting example of how Fleming sort of goes halfway as far as an upgrade from Vesper is, where because of that backstory, we said, oh, okay, so she sort of knew how to take advantage of her own skill set, because she seems to say, oh, it was a lot of fun and I made some money. But at the same time, Mr. Big shows up. Then again, Mr. Big overpowers a lot of people, so in Solitaire's defense, it's not entirely her fault. But, you know, because of that, she also becomes a damsel in distress. So I guess it's, you know, we go sort of halfway as far as that, but it's better. I do kind of like Solitaire, you know.
I like her, but I don't love her. You know,
they'll be better. They'll be better in the books.
I know. I remember. She's okay for now.
Yeah, she's all right. We do get the return. Now, some characters from Casino don't come back. There's no René Mathis in here, but there is.
Come on, we're going to talk about Felix.
Exactly.
Do you like Felix as much as I do in this book?
I find Fleming's play here very interesting, and here's why. So we got to see a little bit of Felix in the previous book, and he seemed like a pretty cool guy. I think you and I were pretty mm-hmm. positive on Felix in the other book. Now, obviously, we're on American soil, so obviously Felix will play a bigger role, which he does. And he's made out to be like a really cool guy and really always smiling and joking. And, you know, despite the fact that they've only been on one mission before, they're the best of pals. And I'm reading this and I'm enjoying hanging out with Felix. But Fleming is building him up so much. Do you think he's just doing that because he wants to feed him to the sharks so he get the emotional punch?
I don't know, because I read in my notes. Well, let me bring my notes. I don't know. There are two things. First off, in the original draft, Felix actually died.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
Felix was murdered. I think it's his editor or probably somebody convinced him, don't kill him off. So he was fully intent in killing him.
Mm. He is fun. He's always, despite the danger, whereas Bond, unlike in the movies where he's always throwing a lot of quips, the Bond of the books doesn't really do that very much. Felix sort of fills that role. Like, he's very happy-go-lucky. He's mm-hmm. kind of devil-may-care attitude as well.
I like the way he gets out from Mr. Big's henchman.
Yes.
He talks his way out.
Yeah.
And that makes him... Like, Bond has to kill people. And, well, Felix is just going to talk about music.
Yeah, jazz and the good bands and how they like their... Not their guitarists. What? How do they like their soloists or something like that?
I think it's their
bassists, maybe?
No, their leader or their band leader, I think.
And him and the henchmen who have him at gunpoint, they agree. And like, yeah, we left on pretty good terms. And Bond, in the meantime, has his pinky finger broken. He has to throw someone down the stairs before breaking his ankles. It's like... It's tough on Bond, whereas Felix is just having just
a good time.
He's having a great time. He's having a ball when he's held at gunpoint. So that's a lot of fun, and but things get a little bit more serious. Not that they're not serious before, but things definitely take a turn for the worse. Oh, you had something for us?
I had something. I was proud of this one because Felix actually mentions that he wrote for the New York Amsterdam News. That was a weekly newspaper geared to African American community in New York City, and he did a series on Orson Welles' all-black cast Macbeth.
He mentions that. Yeah, he does mention.
And do you get where I'm going with this? What's the connection between Orson Welles and the world of James Bond?
Well, Orson Welles, great magician that he was. Played Le Chiffre in the spoof Casino Royale.
You earn an i5.
That's right. Thank you very much, sir.
I put a picture.
He's such a nice looking man in that picture.
Yeah, I know, I know.
Apparently, he hated being on that set, too. Well, you're the brains of this operation. I'm just the charm. So.
Hey!
But no, good stuff there. Now, we've been to Harlem, we've been to the St. Regis Hotel, we go down to good old Florida to see the Oldsters. Later in the book, and this is where things—it's kind of weird because there are a lot of joke, especially Felix Leiter. He likes joking about the Oldsters. They go to this place outside of St. Petersburg, or maybe they're in St. Petersburg, or just outside of St. Petersburg. That's this fictional community, I believe, is fictional community where a lot of old people go to catch some sun before they catch some definitive Z's. Felix thinks it's pretty funny until he gets fed to a shark. It's kind of funny how that sequence turns out. Like, they go to they're aware of
they're following the pipeline that Mr. Big smuggles gold from Jamaica back to the States. There's a fish salesman
or like worms, anything you would need to fish, as well as selling exotic fish.
Yeah.
So they seem to do a little bit of everything at this point. They swing by there on an afternoon, I think. There's this very disagreeable-looking fellow with a shotgun who tells them to, you know, F off. And so they have some drinks later on, and Felix decides to, while Bond is resting, Felix decides to get a head start and go there early in the morning. And this sort of sets off a series of events. We don't know at that time that Felix has landed into some deep water, if you might say. Bond gets a telephone call saying Felix is in the hospital.
Yeah.
He goes to the hospital. Obviously, Felix is not there.
He goes back
to his motel, some sort of motel by the water. And they've brought back Felix in bandages. Well, they being Mr. Big's operation, obviously. And there's a little note, I believe.
He disagreed with something that hate him.
Which is a pretty nasty little note, I like.
P.S. We have plenty more jokes as good as this.
Mr. Big sense of humor shining through.
He writes a lot of notes. And I like those notes. Unless I was like, oh, that's kind of nice. Oh.
Well, Bond comments on them, maybe less so the he disagreed with something that ate him, and but more the other notes that more have are more aligned with voodooism, chants, and this and that. I think Bond seems to remark once or twice in the book that this is partially what Mr. Big does to preserve control over his minions because they're so easily influenced by voodooism. So he sends these little messages, and maybe the survivor of the attack, or maybe an ally of someone that just died, will read the note and say, oh my god, I can't mess with Mr. Big. He is the Baron Samedi, after all. Bond is not fooled by that. The scene where Bond finds Felix, it's pretty grotesque. It's yeah. really gross, actually. The bandages and the blood, and it's even stomach-churning for Bond a little bit. He sort of turns away at some point.
It angers him. Like, it really, it gives him bloodlust. The following night, he goes for revenge.
Pretty much. Lays waste to that guy pretty nastily. And then it's off everybody's favorite place on the globe, Jamaica.
Jamaica. And then he goes to L'Île de la Surprise,
where many surprises await.
For sure.
Some characters that we'll see again later on, even in the movies, like Strangways and Quarrel. It was nice to see. I had forgotten that Quarrel was in the book, actually.
Oh, really?
Not the first time I read the book, and yet I couldn't remember, which is weird because I know Bond goes to Jamaica a few times in the books, and Quarrel's, that's where he's located, but for some reason I couldn't remember that. Apparently gives great massages, great Fleming descriptions. A little bit of Strangways, although we don't get to see Strangways a little bit.
We learned that he has an eye patch.
That's kind of cool, actually. Yeah, I like that. I like that little
detail.
It's
about the same age as Bond. I imagine he was, he might have been older. They say he's 35.
Well, Bond in the book is what, mid-30s, early yeah. to mid-30s, something like that?
Always mid-30s-ish.
Yeah. Keep it general, sort of precise, but also sort of vague. I mean, essentially, Bond, he's training
yeah.
to get to Île of Surprise and destroy Mr. Big's operation. So he trains for about a week. Not a whole lot happens except great massages and great food, but
he stops smoking, stops drinking.
That's true. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. That is a big moment in Bond's life. I'm sure he goes back to smoking
in
the books.
It's a temporary fix.
Oh, very temporary, actually. But there's a really awesome passage. It's the night where Bond says, okay, tonight's the night. I got to go see Mr. Big and his minions. And he does it underwater. And that's a really cool.
That's one of my favorite parts of the book, when he goes underwater. Like, I've done snorkeling once in my life. And I can't even imagine what he goes through, because Fleming describes that portion of the book is fascinating. It's gripping. It's just, it puts a picture in your mind. You can see the tapestry and the wording. Everything is so beautiful. And it's same time, it's a little bit scary.
It's an alien world. It's which it kind of is. I mean, we've all been to the zoo. We've all seen lions and tigers and bears. How many of us have gone underwater to see what lurks beneath? Like, not that many of us. So,
especially the way he describes the way that Mr. Biggs drives
the barracudas and the
insane.
Shark. Yeah, oh, that's gross too.
And yes, it is.
Bond does eventually make it to Isle of Surprise and puts a limpet mine on the. We haven't even mentioned the Secateur.
The Secateur,
which is the boat that Mr. Big is using to smuggle the gold coins from Jamaica to the United States. So there's a limpet mine on the Secateur. Bond reacquaints himself with Solitaire, although they're both kidnapped by Mr. Big. Basically, it's like an awesome finale with this explosion. They're tied together. And they get a little bit bloody because their bodies are being dragged over the coral reefs. And well, his ship blows up. I love that description. I love it when things blow up in Fleming's book. I love it when the two Serbs get blown up in Casino Royale, and I love it when the Secateur blows up in Live and Let Die. There was lightning in the sky, and there's a flash. I don't know what it is about Fleming describing explosions, but it's great. It's because Bond and Solitaire, they don't see the explosion. They only see like the flashes and their bodies jump out of the water. So it's the description of someone that knows an explosion happened but only saw it in flashes and felt it. So it's a really awesome conversation. Description, I meant to say.
It's quite a finale. For the longest time, Mr. Big thinks he's on top of things, that he's gonna succeed, and it literally blows up in his face.
Oh yeah. But he's not dead.
No,
he's not dead.
Not for long. He tries to swim, but nature takes its course.
hoisted on his own petard. He liked to dispatch with spies thanks to Barracuda and Shark. And guess who takes care of him at the end of the book?
He becomes the main course, of course.
Ooh, well played. Well, you're the one with the
I'm on fire. I'm on fire.
Last week it was me. You're taking over this time. But yeah, absolutely. And it's an appropriately... For all the grotesque ways in which Mr. Big has dispatched with his challengers, it's a very appropriate way.
It's a fitting end.
Absolutely. It's gross. It's described in a really gross way, too.
Doesn't it? I'm not sure if I caught... I understood the end properly, but at the end, only like his head is just floating around.
Parts of his... I don't remember if his head... I wouldn't be surprised, but I know like there's an arm, but there's no rest of the body that's floating. And so, yeah, it's the water becomes brown. And yeah, so it's very, very gross. Solitaire and Bond barely make it out of it alive, but they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they earn a little bit of respite. What is it? Bond says, you have to take care of me because my hand is still recuperating.
It's also his shoulder.
His shoulder, it's true.
Barracuda takes a chunk of his shoulder.
Solitaire says, you know, what about my back? And you know, little joke to end the book on. They'll obviously be shaggy very much. And that's how the book ends, basically.
Yeah. Thoughts and feelings?
Enjoyable. I don't know if I like it more or less than Casino Royale. I think it's on par. I think it has a superior villain. It has a superior Bond girl. I think maybe I like the locations a little bit more in Casino, although which is odd because we don't see as many locations in Casino Royale. But I think I like them a little bit more. They feel a little bit more romantic in Casino Royale. In Live and Let Die, it's again, there's that odd, you know, exoticism for things that, like, in 2017, it's like, this is really odd. But I think it's certainly more graphic than
yes, it is. It is so much more. It's more violent than the first one.
You know what it's like? I think it's, and Fleming never hid the fact that he wrote these books for money. He was damn good at it, but he wrote them for money. He said this on a number of occasions. It's like he saw that the sales for Casino Royale were probably decent, and he said, well, if you like that, there's a lot more where that came from. What's Solitaires is described in a very sexy way. Again, that scene when Mr. Big is going to have Bond's pinky finger broken. Like, Solitaire sits down in a way that her like breasts are like very visible. Like, she puts her arms in a way that sort of squeezes her breasts a little bit. And the deaths are very, very graphic. So he really ups the ante this time around. So it's a bit of a different experience. I think I like it as much as Casino Royale.
There are things I prefer in Casino Royale, things I prefer in Live and Let Die, but it's two different experiences. One's barely a thriller, and this one's almost more like an action-adventure movie. I mean, you go from location to location, fights villains. He's more a passive character in Casino Royale. Casino is like, Royale is a prequel to Live and Let Die in a way, because I didn't measure it, but I think it's a bigger book.
It is, by a good 50 or 60 pages.
Feels like it, too. I mean, just because he goes from different locations, it feels more like what eventually what we know as the movies will become. Yeah. It's a more travelogue.
Even just with the villain alone, like Le Chiffre is such a he's not disposable, but in another
he's
way,
incompetent.
He is. Yeah, he's a little bit incompetent. Whereas Mr. Big feels like what today in 2017, after tons of books and movies, we would describe as a proper Bond villain. Mr. Big is a proper Bond villain.
Yes. He's a villain on purpose, not because of his predicament.
Precisely, exactly. And the Bond girl feels more like a proper Bond girl as well. Fleming is discovering his rhythm with these books right now. Because this is not the last time we're going to get a book that's kind of violent. They get kind of gross at times.
They are disturbing at times.
If you thought Bond's Thunderballs getting whacked was gross the first time, we're going to see a few weird things in the next few weeks and months.
I have a few notes about the writing of the book. The location of Isle of the Surprise is near the Firefly Estate. Pirate's Gold, it was Henry Morgan, Bloody Morgan, that's mentioned plenty of times. Well, one of Fleming's friends, Noel Coward, actually owned that home for a time. And when you... I'll show you pictures, because when you see, that's what he had in front of you. Island, I think, Carabita. If you Google that name, or just Google Firefly Estate and Google a few pictures of that estate, there's a giant island. And it looks like it has a few caverns on the side.
That's true. Bond probably sneaks in through there. And there's also that sequence where he and, this is before Bond goes to the Isle of Soap, he and Quarrel are driving along the coast and they stop off a cliff and they sort of have a slightly higher view of the mountain. And it looks exactly like that picture, actually. Or the description in the book looks exactly like that picture.
And that's the view of Noel Coward's, from Noel Coward's home. This is where the island is.
There you go.
There you go.
They probably parked that car right there.
Exactly. Yeah. We usually do the leftover section, and I feel like this one, is they left so much of the book. Some for good reason, some the gold plot thing. I don't know if it would work in a modern setting, but I love it. I don't know. There's something about people smuggling gold and using it to finance illegal things, but even... We chat brief sometimes, and I don't understand why the British government has to be involved in that plot.
I think it's because, and it's a fair question, because he spent so much time in the United States and so such little time in Jamaica, which theoretically at that time is still, I think it's still a British colony, or maybe they still have some sort of influence over the Jamaican islands, the British, that is. But I think it's because they believe the source of this Bloody Morgan gold being funneled into the United States is Jamaica, and that's where the British have some sort of authority as opposed to the Americans. So it ultimately leads into Jamaica, but he spent so much time in the United States, which is FBI ground and Felix Leiter territory, that you're like, well, what the hell is Bond doing here? It doesn't make any sense. It's a fun book. It's a fun read, but as far as structure goes, yeah, it's an extremely long-winded way to get Bond to where ultimately he's supposed to be anyways.
Yeah.
I mean, no complaints. I still enjoy it to an extent. But you were saying a lot of stuff that they left out of the book. There's the whole train, the Silver Phantom. I think they ride the Silver Phantom. He and Solitaire. That's not really in... Well, he's in the train at the very end of the movie. But other than that, there's that whole train ride where he has maybe an informant that's willing to work with him. Yeah, none of that is in the film. They don't use the Felix Leiter as shark bait yet. It's true, there are some fairly obvious differences, but then again, in the film, this Mr. Big type character is funneling cocaine into the United States. So he's still like smuggling something. Yeah. But I understand the romanticism of the gold. It's very, it makes it come across as a bit of a swashbuckling adventure. You know?
It is. Pirates. Well, it is definitely a pirate story.
Yeah.
They're looking for a treasure. It's Treasure Island with spies.
All y'all Pirates of the Caribbean fans out there, just pick up Live and Let Die. Then you get your fix like that.
But also, you know, they brought back Felix Leiter with both arms and legs. And in the movies after License to Kill, when they rebooted the franchise, rereading that book, I'm like, they could bring Strangways in modern movies and Quarrel. People, I don't know how you would do a character like that, especially Quarrel, because he's almost like a manservant in those films and the books. He's borderline. But I was thinking Mr. Big. I would love to see Mr. Big. It's a shame that Michael Clark Duncan died so young. He would have been perfect.
He would have been pretty good, actually.
He would have been so perfect. And I can, with the voice, the way he used to speak, very like.
Well, deep. I think, you know what? I just got an idea. Let's get Idris Elba. Let's feed him a lot of cheeseburgers and poutine. Have him put him on that diet for about 6 months. Pay him a nice salary. We'll get him as Mr. Big.
Mr. Big. He's not big enough. You would need
some... Well, he's big, but exactly. Hence the cheeseburgers and fries.
No, but I mean, he's not tall. You need... what's the guy from even that guy. The guy from... I forget his name. Brooklyn 99.
Oh, Terry Crews.
Terry Crews. But Terry Crews, the problem is that I don't want to see him as a villain. Like, I find him too funny to picture him as a villain, even though he's... played villains in other movies. I just like him too much on that show. I don't want to see him as a bad guy.
He's pretty awesome.
But physically, that's like
Michael bulky. Clark Duncan would have done the trick.
He would have been perfect, but his heart gave up way too early.
Funnily enough, Mr. Big had some heart issues.
Oh, that's funny. I googled that to see if it was actually a thing, and there's a condition where your skin can turn gray temporary, but it's more something for white people. And people, and like I googled it, and people actually look like Smurfs. It's really weird.
Okay.
It's really disturbing, but apparently...
Well, this Daniel Craig era is trying to be more gritty and real, so maybe we'll have Smurfs as the villain in Bond 25.
Smurf.
Oh, very well. Very, very good.
We're going to bring back Smurf. I think we're all going to bring this episode to a close, because...
I think so. I got nothing left. I've expensed everything I have to say about Live and Let Die.
All right. So, do you want to close this show?
Absolutely. So thanks as always for listening. You can reach us online, digitally, Twitter. We also have a Facebook page, which is the James Bond Complex. I believe we have an email account, which is something like the jamesbondcomplex@gmail.com.
Yes.
Something like that. Yes, I am on Twitter at @OH_pop. You're on Twitter at
Matt O'Clair.
But there's also a Twitter
for James Bond Complex.
Absolutely. At the James Bond Complex. And we're working on a website, I believe. James Bond will return in Live and Let Die, the film, 1973.
That's it.
Merci beaucoup.
À plus tard.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.